So I'm doing things a tiny bit different tonight. I'm just trying this out. I've basically made an entire PowerPoint out of our agenda packet. So if you do have the video capability, you should be able to follow along. Welcome to the Zone 3 Advisory Committee. Our agenda tonight, let's see if I'm doing this. Our agenda tonight is the following. And I will let Karen, chairman of the Zone 3 Advisory Committee, call the meeting to order.
Karen, we can't hear you.
Yeah, you're muted, Karen.
Here we go.
Yep.
So let's officially call this meeting of the Zone 3 Advisory Committee November 19th, 2020 to order. And if you would please do a roll call.
We will. Member Bright.
Here.
Member Barnage.
Here.
Member Gibson.
Here.
Member Guthrie?
Here.
Member Hageman?
Here.
Member Talley?
Here.
And Member Riley?
Here.
All right. I'd like to introduce Ron. He's our newest member representing the member at large position. And I thought I might be a good time for Ron, maybe just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Oh, on the spot. Okay. I have the good fortune of knowing a good number of you. Those of you I haven't met before, I'll look forward to a day we can work together in an actual chamber of some sort. But I'm Ron Riley, President, CEO at Gehring, Taylor & Associates. Yes, I do know Jim Gehring quite well. We are in contact now and then. And I've been fortunate to be at that company since the beginning of 2015 and have followed Zone 3 water issues pretty closely in that time. I've been in the civil engineering industry since 2003 and have lived here in Grover Beach with my wife since 2013 and our children since they were born here as well. We've got two young children. And yeah, these are just issues that are near and dear to our heart. So I'm really excited to be able to weigh in where I can, maybe offer some of the history that was handed down to me now and again, and to hear the different perspectives from everybody here. So thank you all for having me, and it's really a privilege to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ron, for stepping up and taking the place of our last member at large. We really appreciate you doing that. Thank you very kindly. Okay, then why don't we move on to public comment. This is an opportunity for members of the public to address the committee on items that are not on the agenda. Do we have any public comment at this time?
I have one thing, but I'll let somebody else go. I'll chime in last. I do not have any public comments showing here on my in the chat room. So,
okay then.
All right. So my my comment is that I wanted everyone to know that the State Office of Environmental Health Hazard published a fish advisory for Lopez Lake on November 10th that offers safe eating advice for 7 fish species based on levels of mercury found in fish caught from the lake. That came as a surprise to me, but our water quality lab manager, Faith Sinker, had forwarded it on to me, so I thought you should all know about that.
Would you mind repeating that, please?
Yeah, the State Office of Environmental Health Hazard published a fish advisory for Lopez Lake on November 10th that offers safe eating advice for 7 fish species based on levels of mercury found in fish caught from the lake.
So would that be just for that day, or do you have any more information
about that? No, but it does say that if you wanted more information, it says advisories are available on the California Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment fish advisories webpage. It doesn't state how long it's good for.
Okay.
But there is quite a bit of other information on this form. That was just the main thing.
Okay. Thank you. All right then. I guess then we'll move on to the approval of minutes of September 17th, 2020, the regular meeting. That would be attachment one. Does anybody have any corrections, additions to those minutes? If not, I would entertain a motion.
This is Councilmember Barnage, so moved.
Second.
Very good. We have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Very good. Thank you.
All right.
Very good. So we can move now along to item number four, the approval of the 2021 meeting schedule. That would be attachment two in our packet. Oh, and there it is right on the screen. Oh my gosh. Look at us. We're like moving right into the 21st century here.
18th century now.
Does anyone have any questions or issues with this schedule? Wouldn't it be nice if we actually could really follow the schedule and maybe go back to the old?
I did put a note at the bottom of the calendar, I believe, and basically stating that all the meetings would be go-to meetings unless, you know, something changes. And then when it does change, I will work to get, you know, location for meetings.
Terrific. Okay, so unless there's any objections to this, do we need a motion for this then?
Yes, please. And a roll call vote, if you wouldn't mind, just because with all the I's and no's, it's hard to say exactly what's right. Happening. I think we should just try to do the roll call whenever that possible. Makes sense.
Okay, very good. So we'll just continue on in that fashion then. So
This is Kristen Barnage, and I would move for approval.
Very good. May I have a second?
Second, Brian Talley.
Thank you. And a roll call vote, please.
All right. Member Barnage?
Yes.
Member Bright?
Yes.
Member Guthrie?
Yes.
Member Gibson?
Yes.
Member Hageman?
Yes.
Member Talley?
Yes.
Member Riley?
Yes.
All right. Thank you very much. All right. We are moving
on to the operations report.
Yeah.
Thank you.
The first one up here is the water operations report from Jenny Williamson, who I believe is on the line.
Hello.
Jenny, do you have the today's operations report?
Hey, Jill, this is Kristen. I happened to see that she put a message into it, popped up on my screen a couple minutes ago, said she was having problems with her audio. And then it said Jill has left the meeting. So I don't know.
Can you guys hear me now?
Oh, there we go.
Yes.
Okay, I apologize about that. For whatever reason, the settings on my computer keeps changing and it's really driving me nuts tonight. So I apologize for the delay. I do have the numbers for Lopez operations if everybody is ready. So the numbers for tonight, the lake elevation is at 481.93. Storage is at 20,629 acre feet. Capacity is at 42%. Rainfall to date is at 0.68. Plant production is at 5.4 MGD. State water is currently at 0 MGD. And downstream release is at 3.4.
Great. Thank you, Jenny.
This is Kristen. Sorry, this is Kristen. Can I get the rainfall to date one more time, please?
Sure, not a problem. Rainfall to date is at 0.68 inches.
Thank you.
And Jenny, this is Brad. The state water is not back up yet, or?
That's correct. It's currently shut off due to some issues going on with the state line. Jill, I think you have a little bit more information on that, exactly what it is that's kind of going on, I think.
Yeah, annually, the State Water Project shuts down for maintenance. And during that time, it's usually about 3 weeks. I believe it will be back on. Oh, it went off. I believe it went off in the end of October and it just went back on. So I believe on the, what day is today? It was either, maybe it's tomorrow. They'll be turning State Water back on. And so we'll be going back to our normal disinfectant, which is total chlorine. For the last 3 weeks, we've only been taking Lopez water. And when we do that, we take that opportunity to change disinfectants to clean out the biofilm that builds up in the pipeline. So basically, within the next day or two, we will have state water turned back on and we'll be taking it again.
Yeah, I thought I saw a note from Craig, and I was trying to think if it was today or yesterday, but that was my sense. But then when she said no flow, I guess it just hasn't quite got back up again. So thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, very good. Well, thank you. So we'll move on now to the projected reservoir levels.
Yeah, we have been working, one of my engineers that works with me, Desiree Bravo, and I think she is on the line. Hi, Desiree. She was tasked with kind of improving this storage projection chart because it seemed like the model that we were using, we were just getting farther and farther away from what the projection was. And so she's been working on this to improve it. And the one thing on this that we are still unable to improve is the prediction of rainfall. So those numbers that are at the bottom in blue where it says 0.44, 0.99, they still come from a website called longrangeweather.com. And there just isn't any other website that predicts, you know, rainfall like this. So that being said, she worked hard on kind of improving our model so that we can have a better understanding of the reservoir's response to rainfall. So I thought I would let Desiree, if you have any questions, feel free to ask. And Desiree, maybe you could tell them just a little bit about kind of how you improved it, like what you changed.
Sure, in a not a problem. non-technical way. actually, my notes are all very, a little bit technical, but okay, I'll try my best. So I guess in a nutshell, one of the main issues with the older model was that it only took into account inflow values for rainfall up to 4.5 inches. And so this new model was recalibrated so that we can see how the rainfall affects our reservoir levels up to a monthly total of 15 inches. So I don't know if you guys remember from the past, but there were a couple of months where we had over 5 inches, and I believe on one month we had over 8 inches, and we didn't really see the old model really being affected by those months. So recalibrating those inflows, we were able to get a model that was more reflective of our actual reservoir water levels. The other thing that we changed were we incorporated an antecedent factor. So what this does, our older model really didn't change when for months where we had an average rainfall of greater than an inch. So for example, for the first rainstorms after months of no rain, we don't expect much of the inflow since the soil will likely absorb most of it before it reaches the reservoir, as opposed to rainstorms during the rainy season. So our new model essentially breaks it up into two months where we have an average daily rainfall of over or below 1 inch, and then an average daily rainfall of greater than an inch. And so our inflow takes that into account, and yes, that's how we came up with the new model, I guess.
Thank you. So what you can see here on the graph that she's created, this one, that if we were to get the rainfall that's predicted, that 0.44, the 0.99, and on up, you can see the red line indicates where the current model that she's created would anticipate what the reservoir level would look like. And the yellow line is still what the storage projection would be if we receive no rain.
Correct.
So, right. And so, and you can see at the bottom there, in the month of, I guess that would have been September, it was predicted we would get 0.44 inches and we got none, and that we would have gotten an inch in the month of October and we have seen none. So we're tracking low right now, but that's part of the problem with not having a better source of data for predicted rainfall.
May I ask a question?
Sure.
Yes.
I heard a moment ago something about 0.6 inches year to date.
Mm-hmm.
When did we start measuring that? Is it the water year that begins on April 1st?
No, it is. It begins on July 1st. And that rainfall was received in November, which is why it doesn't show it here on the graph, because this graph is through October 31st. And I don't believe we got any rainfall until November.
That is correct. We had zero rainfall up to October 31st.
So we're projected for, you know, roughly 1.4 inches through November, and we're less than halfway there with 10 days to go in November.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, let me, this is Brad again, not to get too far in the weeds. We were projected to be an inch and a half at the end of October, and we've got none, And for the month of November, we're projecting 2.17. Is that correct?
Yes.
So we're, as of October 31st, we were an inch and a half behind. And for, I guess, total, we're 0.68 versus an inch and a half plus 2.17. So.
Right. So along those lines, I wanted to show you. So I recently was in contact with our counterpart at NOAA, and he shared this with me. I thought it was kind of interesting. It shows that where we are in terms of drought for California and basically the West, last year, you can see on the left on the left side, 1 year ago, only portions of Nevada were abnormally dry. Looking at the right side, you can see that now most of the West is considered to have some kind of drought conditions. In addition to that, the next slide gives you an idea of what our chances are for a wet winter or one above normal. He shared this slide, which I thought was interesting as well. And that is that all the gray bars show La Nina events since 1998. And so you can see that since 1998, there have only been seven La Nina years. And of those, only two were significantly wetter than normal. And that was in 2006 and 2011. All the others were either very close to normal or less. So if you were to be kind of a glass half empty, you might say that this year is probably tracking to be a less than normal rainfall year.
Great.
Yeah, great. Any questions on the projections or any comments, weather?
I would just comment that if we are anticipating a less than average year, then I see a couple points on that previous slide where we're basically into a low reservoir situation by January.
Correct.
And I know that we're in the midst of trying to figure out what that new low reservoir situation looks like, but perhaps with a month and a half to go, maybe we would talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, that's exactly. And we discussed this at the Technical Advisory Committee meeting in November, and we kind of decided that we would talk about it some more in December, but given what needs to happen for us to enter the low reservoir response plan, we should be sure before we start down that road that it is actually going to be beneficial, because if we go to a lot of work to enact the low reservoir response plan and then find out that, you know, at the end of March or April, we're back up at 25,000 or even 30,000 acre feet, it probably doesn't make sense to go to put a lot of effort into heading into the low reservoir response plan. So my recommendation at this point would be to tackle that at the end of March. And if we, you know, if this rain year does turn out to be low, then and we don't recover very well, we could start on that process to have the Board of Supervisors declare a water shortage for zone 3 and go through the process of enacting the low reservoir response plan again.
Jill, could you put up that slide again with the El Nino, La Nina graph?
Yeah.
Okay. So I think what I have heard is that what the experts are predicting is a La Nina water year, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So then when you look at, okay, so why is 2020 blue? Is that El Nino? But yeah, I thought you said we were La Nina.
Yeah, I don't know why that's, I don't know if that, I'm not sure if I have the, if they have the dates right. As I'm looking at the bottom, I'm trying to figure that out. It does seem incorrect, unless their water, unless this water year is because it's spanning 1819,
mm-hmm.
1920,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to, you know, so they're not actually showing the year that we're heading into, which is 2021. That's my guess.
Okay. And I don't know if anyone can answer this or how, just maybe a real, if anyone knows a real brief answer to how do these experts know it's, they think it's going to be a La Nina year? Is that just looking at the weather we've had recently or looking at the ocean currents or something? I can't remember and I want to try to refresh my memory on that.
Yeah, it does have to do with the temperature of the water down the equator, but that's, he went into that, the counterpart that I know at NOAA, but I couldn't explain it to you again, but
okay.
You're right, it does have something to do with water temperatures. Does anybody else have any insight?
Wikipedia is a great resource.
Okay. I'll look there after the meeting. Thanks, Brian.
it does have something to do with temperatures at a certain latitude in south in the Pacific.
Yeah.
But the details, I don't know.
Alrighty then. Are there any other questions? Are we?
We're on projected reservoir levels, and we can move on. If there's no further questions, move on to the monthly operations reports. All right, so before you on the screen is the September monthly operations report. You'll see that the total deliveries this month, which includes state water, was 528 acre feet. We've still been in a pattern. We are still increasing on water usage at this point, and that's to be expected since we had such a dry September and October. In the month of September, you can see over here that Oceano began to take the surplus water that it purchased. And other than that, everybody else is still just using up their entitlement. Nothing really exceptional on the September one. October is similar. Again, we're inching up. Now we're at 537 acre feet for the month of October. And everybody except Oceano is continuing to use their entitlement. And we have, as of October 30th, 1,312 acre feet of stored state water. Any questions on this?
Okay. Okay. I hear none. So guess then we'll move along here.
All right, Christy will discuss the first quarter budget status as well as some recent changes to this year's budget. Christy?
Hi, Christy Smith, County Public Works Finance. This is the first quarter budget status report for fiscal year 2020-2021. The report covers July 1st through September 30th. And at the end of the first quarter, our total expenses were 16% of the annual budget. So attachment 5 in your packet includes three graphs illustrating the budget versus the actual expenses. So the first graph that Jill's got up there is your routine O&M. The expenses were 22% of the budget, and we have a remainder of $3.2 million available for the rest of the year. The next slide, the next graph is going to be for non-routine O&M. Most of this category's budget was carried forward from the prior year, so we can continue working on these efforts. At the end of September, the expenses were only 2% of the budget, so we have approximately $1.6 million left for the rest of the year. The third graph, moving right along, for capital outlay, roughly half of this category's budget was carried forward from the prior year. So again, we want to continue working on these projects. At the end of the quarter, the expenses were 9% of the budget, and we have almost $480,000 left for the remainder of the year. So the fiscal year 19-20 true-up has been done, and those billing adjustments were mailed out earlier this month, along with the second installment of the fiscal year 2020-2021 billings that are due January 1st. Later tonight in the projects update, you're going to hear about the cathodic protection repair project. This project was not budgeted for at the beginning of the year. So Jill, you can probably put up our next slide. This slide will show you we were able to cobble together almost $450,000 this year to begin the project. And the advisory committee doesn't need to take any action. This is just internally, we want to show you how we've moved some budget around. So this chart lists projects that we've moved budget from to provide funding for the cathodic protection repair project. The first column shows the amount of the budget each project had at the start of the fiscal year. The middle column shows you the budget we've moved, so the brackets represent negatives, and then down towards, it's all gone to that last line for the cathodic protection repair project. And then the final column there is where we currently show our budget for each of the projects. So we felt that the risk assessment, that very first line, that project could be done this year for $40,000. So we moved all the additional budget. The cloud seeding program had carried forward around $140,000 in savings from last fiscal year's program. So we decided to move that over as well and keep $350,000 for this year's program. The ammonia analyzers and the cathodic protection survey have both been completed, so the remaining budget there, the savings, was also moved. And so that gets us to about $450,000. So that's the end of my report. Do you have any questions at this point?
I'll go ahead and ask. So am I understanding that we've made available $450,000 that we can put towards what we believe to be an $800,000 project?
Yes.
Correct. Okay.
And the project theoretically would take some time to design and get specifications together and get out to bid, and perhaps there would be room in next year's budget to finish off what we don't get to this year. Is that the thought?
That's correct, Ron. We're actually, and Desiree's on the line. This is really her project. That initially it came out that from a budgetary estimate standpoint, somewhere around $884,000, I believe, and we offered them different phasing plans, and they definitely wanted to start it this year, even though we did not have any budget for it, which is why we've moved budget around so that we could start it this year. Desiree, do you remember, can you explain a little bit like what phase one is versus phase two and phase three?
Yeah, sure. Yes, I'm unmuted. Okay, so we gave them three options. The difference between option one, two, and three, option one pretty much broke up the project into separately repairing each one of the units individually. So replacing the ICCP system in unit one in phase two, and then doing unit two and unit three each year after. Option two we broke it down into, instead of doing each unit separately, doing each phase by type of work that was going to be done. So for example, replacing all of the rectifiers and anode beds and the test stations first, and then the next phase would essentially be to do a continuity test to repair all of the broken bonds. And the reason why we broke it up that way was because we thought that if we separated it by type, we could potentially see cost savings. And then option three was taking into account the fact that we only had a certain amount of money to work with for the first 2 years. So as Christy mentioned, though option three pretty much took into account the, what was it, $450,000, Christy, in savings that we had this year. So any more questions?
So, yes, please. So I see in the O&M non-routine category, the cathodic protection maintenance is listed there. So, first of all, can you tell me what cathodic protection is?
Yeah. So, essentially, it's a technique used to protect the metal components of a system from corroding.
Okay.
There's two basic types of systems. You can either install a galvanic cathodic protection system or an impressed current cathodic protection system. And that pretty much depends on the area that you want to protect. So for long areas, you want to use an ICCP system. In the case of a tank, it's more cost efficient to use a galvanic system.
Mm-hmm.
And do you want me to go into the details of how that's done, or
so, in layman terms, please?
Yeah,
but it's metal protection of the systems, basically.
Correct. Uh-huh.
Okay.
And now, so, in the event of the difference between an ICCP system and a galvanic, one is obviously more costly than the other. Mm-hmm. In the case of the pipelines, we have to protect miles of pipe, and you're not able to do that effectively using a galvanic system, which is cheaper. So for that reason, we have to install an ICCP system. But in the event of a tank, it's a lot cheaper. There's no need to install an ICCP system. So for that, we opted for the galvanic option. What specific details?
Okay. So, now you were saying that you're talking about doing this in three separate.
Yes. So, the assessment, the cathodic protection assessment that we conducted earlier or last year, the entire Zone 3 distribution system is composed of 5 units. Mm-hmm. We only addressed units 1, 2, and 3 because of the units 4 and 5. The type of pipe doesn't really require us to install a cathodic protection system. Now, units 1 and unit 3 already had previously a system installed. But after the assessment came back, it's the anode beds and the rectifiers are completely corroded, so they're no longer serving their purpose. And as it stands, the system is not being cathodically protected at all. So it's freely corroding at this moment.
I see.
Yeah, unit 2, it didn't have a cathodic protection system previously installed. Because of it's a different type of pipe versus units 1 and 3. But it turns out that the passive layer of the concrete surrounding the steel pipe is degrading. So, mm-hmm. The potential values that were obtained showed that the system would benefit at this point from also having an ICCP system installed in that unit.
I see. So then this first maintenance, do we know, is it going to be for one particular tank, or I guess I don't really need to know that. We don't need to get that specific, I guess.
Again, of the entire length of pipeline, we only need to protect three units and the domestic tank. We don't need to protect the fire tank because that we're intending on replacing pretty soon. So there's really no benefit in protecting that one at the moment if we're going to be replacing it. Our main focus, is to just focus on units 1, 2, 3 and the domestic tank, which is at the Lopez Water Treatment Plant.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
So I just wanted to clarify one thing. So, and that is that, so the way we have it currently set up is that this year we have about $450,000 to do some of the work. And then our plan is to, in 22-23, budget an additional $180,000 to do another phase of the project. And then in 2023-24, we would wrap up the project with another $251,000 worth of work. So that's how we kind of have it laid out at this point.
Okay.
Great. So my last question, and maybe for a lot of people, the thought of asphalt might hit home a little better here. When you lay down new road, it's designed for approximately 20 years. And if you maintain it well, you can potentially double that lifetime or do better. And my understanding is that there was not inspection going on the original cathodic system. So I just want to ensure that we're planning to institute that somehow. I don't know how we enforce it. I don't know how those things work, but if someone would just speak to that, I'd appreciate it.
You've definitely hit on something that, once we make all these repairs, we're definitely going to be budgeting on an annual basis the, a survey of it, and so that we are on top of it. It is unclear to me what the history is on this or why it was not done. I don't know the answer to that, but moving forward, we all recognize that it's important to, once we put all this money into the cathodic protection system, that we have to maintain it. So it'll become part of our normal work orders that we plan for each year.
Very good. Thank you. Good point there, Ron. Any other questions regarding that? Oh, here we are.
Oh, sorry. Just moving right along on my own pace. Sorry.
So are there any other questions before we move along to the cloud seeding? Any other questions on the budget status? Okay, seeing none, then I guess we'll move on then to the cloud seeding update.
So good news. Just this Tuesday on November 17th, we took our cloud seeding program to the Board of Supervisors for approval for year two, and that went smoothly. Along with that item was also to authorize the Public Works Director to execute a lease with the City of AG for an additional ground seeding site. So I'm excited that the City of AG took it to their board to their city council on, I believe it was November 10th, and it passed and they signed it. And so we have it. We just need to have our Public Works Director execute it. And then the North American Weather Consultant, technician will be working with Shane Taylor, and they'll start installing the equipment so that we have another ground seeding site. So this year we'll be utilizing the one at the City of Arroyo Grande's water tank site. I think they call it reservoir number 4. And we'll also be using the site that we used last year kind of sharing the site with Santa Barbara County, which is called Barros Peak, which is east of Napomo, way up in the mountain up there. And the program's going to start on December 1st, and it will run till April 15th. And this year's estimated cost is $180,000. And as you probably noticed, the current budget for this year is actually $350,000. So we will have some savings associated with the cloud seeding. And this is year 2 of a potential year 3 program. So we're, as we come to you moving forward for this 22, for fiscal year 21-22, we're in that budget planning phase. So we'll be wanting confirmation that you all want to have a third year of cloud seeding. And that will come before you in January, I believe, or at least the draft of the budget will come to you in your January meeting. Is that correct, Christy?
Yes, in January, I'll pass out the proposed budget that I've put together based on what TAC has recommended. And so you guys will get a first glimpse at it and have a chance to look it over. And then in February, I meet with the finance folks from the different agencies to discuss any of their questions or concerns. And then in March, I come back to your advisory committee, and that's where I do a presentation and seek endorsement at that time. But between January and March is our time to really firm up things.
And just as a, because I happen to have the budget sheet in front of me, we did take a proposed list of capital improvement projects to the TAC in November, and they recommended we budget $285,000 for the last year of cloud seeding. So they're recommending a third year program, and then that'll be up to this group here to endorse that. But that's their current recommendation. Any questions on cloud seeding?
Doesn't sound like it.
Yes, this is Shirley. So there are just 2 locations that will have ground seeding?
Correct. Yep.
And so there won't be any by airplanes, correct?
Yes. That's true.
And then for my board presentation, for year 1, how much was the rain increased by the cloud seeding? Do you have a number for that?
No. In fact, it's very difficult for them to come up with a number like that. However, because Santa Barbara has had a 30-year program, They did a study, I think it was in 2017, and they analyzed going back, I think, at least 5 or 6 years from then to come up with an estimate of 9 to 17% is what the additional precipitation that they received as a result of cloud seeding. Our consultant could try to do that for us, but with only 1 year's worth of data, it's not going to be very accurate. And it was like an additional cost, so it didn't seem worthwhile.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Jill, maybe you could share the name of the gentleman from the county that really took the lead on that. He had some great data, and that could be helpful for Shirley and anybody else that needs it.
Yeah, that was Ray D'Enzo, I think is who you're talking about. He worked for the county, and he's the one that initiated this. And he worked with our current consultant, North American Weather Consultants, and they're the ones that provided the data because they run the Santa Barbara program and have for at least more than 10 years. They provided, in fact, North American Weather Consultants are the ones that gave this group, the advisory committee, a presentation back in, I believe we had them do it at the end of September. They gave a presentation on what can be expected and how they go about doing these comparisons of it, where they take a specific site or a location that does not receive any, does not do cloud seeding, and they find, and then they compare that to a similar location where we are cloud seeding. I think they call it their control site. But given that it was only 1 year, any data that came out of that and whatever results they came out would probably be suspect, to be honest. So, well, I think it would be a good idea for us to do it at the end of our 3 years, though, because that would probably help to inform this group on whether they want to continue this kind of program.
Okay, thanks for the information. I'll give him a call.
He, unfortunately, Ray does no longer works for the county of San Luis Obispo. So,
oh.
Yeah, if you want other data, the best thing would be for me to give you the contact information of our consultant. So if you want to ask some more specific questions, we can do that. I can send that to you, Shirley.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
Okay. I think now then, if there are no other questions regarding cloud seeding, we can move on now then to the contract changes update.
Yeah. So first off, please note that that should say contract, not contact. you look at these things so many times, and then at the last minute, I'm like, what? How did that happen?
Well, I'm looking at the agenda, and the agenda says contract. So.
Okay, so it's good in one place. Awesome.
Yeah.
So where we're at right now, as you can see, as you move across, as you all know, we've developed the conceptual contract amendments. We've done the reservoir modeling to show that this is that this would be beneficial. We started over the last year, we actually started developing the updated contract language, and we did that by forming a subcommittee of TAC members to really get to the meat of the changes. And since that time, in the end of October, the county's environmental division, who is developing the CEQA document, released their notice of preparation. They anticipate that a draft CEQA document would be ready in March, and then there will be a 60-day public review period between April and May 2021. And while that is going on, we are simultaneously really fine-tuning the language in the contracts so that it's ready for each of the agency's legal counsels to review. So hopefully it can all come together at the same time. So governing board review, maybe June, July, and perhaps as soon as September for Board of Supervisors approval. I might be a little optimistic there, but it really, so far, all the agencies have been working really well together, and I have not seen any anything that would indicate that we're going to run into a snag anywhere. I think this is something that's really going to happen, and I'm hopeful that it happens by September. I think that would be great because one of the things about making these changes, and I think it was somebody here already mentioned, is that if we make these changes to allow for storage for agencies to store water, we actually won't need a low reservoir response plan, because every agency will be in charge of their own water supply and they can manage it as they need. So I'm hopeful that either we get enough rain and we don't have to, you know, put our energy into a low reservoir response plan, and that we can just use this momentum we have for the contract changes to move forward. Any questions about the Zone 3, about these contract changes? I will say that tomorrow our subcommittee will be meeting again, because one of the agencies brought up to the group's attention that we had left out a possible provision in the contract. So we'll be meeting tomorrow to address that and see what we can do. We are also been meeting along the way with our ag reps, keeping them, because they are, although they don't actually have a contract for water, they are part integral to our operations with the Lopez Reservoir. So keeping them in the loop and taking their feedback. So, and I know Brian has been, Brian and Bard Ikeda have both been real helpful in attending the meetings and giving us their input.
And we are thankful to be included.
So are there any questions from the group regarding the contract or the schedule? Okay, hearing none, then why don't we then move along to item 7, the capital projects update.
Let's see, I think items, yeah. So the first one I want to talk to you about before I go into the list of all the projects is one that I wanted to keep your advisory committee up to speed on. We've had some changes recently, so I'm going to do my best to describe where we're headed with the terminal dam decommissioning update. And I think in order to move forward, I kind of go look backwards. So I believe it was in July, we came to your to the committee and we laid out why it might be important to look into terminal dam decommissioning, which would, because at the time we were realizing that the terminal dam, it has a seismic deficiency, and in terms of its recent rating, it is now considered a high hazard dam, and it was given that classification after, I think it was in 2017, after the Oroville Dam kind of disaster, the DSOD changed the way that they classified dams, and they decided that the new classification would be based on what was downstream. And they said, because we had a large community downstream, we're now, the terminal reservoir dam is now considered a high hazard dam, which means it probably doesn't meet standards, seismic standards. Subsequent to that, we had already decided to do a terminal dam assessment. And as we proceeded through that terminal dam assessment and hired a consultant, we realized we didn't have any actual geotechnical information. So the consultant had to base his entire report on as-built plans, had to make a lot of assumptions. And even with that, they believed that it was not built to the proper standards. So, but they suggested that we do some further geotechnical testing to confirm that. And so when we found out that that additional testing was going to be somewhere on the order of $300,000, and I believe it was Jim Gehring, he initially put the thought into everyone's head that maybe we should look at just not using the terminal dam. And the terminal dam is needed because we have a body, our water source has body contact. And so per the water regulations, you have to have 30 days where the water does not have any body contact before you treat it. So, and that was partially because at the time that we built the terminal reservoir, we didn't have that high tech of a water treatment plant. Since that time, in 2007, we upgraded the plant, and now our plant is so much more, it's much more capable of removing what it needs to meet the standards. So in effect, we don't actually need the terminal reservoir in order to meet those standards. So we brought to you in July, kind of laid out all the things we might have to consider what might have to change for us and some dollar amounts that would be associated with terminal dam decommissioning versus seismically retrofitting the dam. And actually Desiree did a ton of work on that. And at the end of the day, we looked at the numbers and it came out that, you know, round numbers, like $10 million to, I believe it was $10 million to retrofit the dam and potentially somewhere on the order of $5.5 million to go through the process of decommissioning the terminal reservoir. And so at that meeting, your group said, yes, let's keep investigating the terminal dam decommissioning. So that's where we were headed after your July meeting. So I thought it would be a really great idea after that we get an entire team together of people here at the county that would have input as to all the things we need to consider if we were going to decommission the terminal reservoir and take direct use of the lake water straight to the water treatment plant. So I invited our water quality lab manager, Faith Zenker, who has 20 years of working with Lopez and is extremely knowledgeable. And she came to TAC, and we first met with her, and she brought up something that was like a huge red flag that I had not considered to that date. And that was that if we didn't have a terminal reservoir, we would have to treat algae blooms up at the lake. And if you're taking water directly after from treatment, it might make things difficult for the water treatment plant to process water that had been treated for algae blooms. But aside from that, she also pointed out that it was possible that we might not be able to release water downstream from time to time because of the chemicals that they use to treat algae blooms. There would be certain potentially limits. You know, we'd have to test the water, and if the water didn't meet the limits, we wouldn't be able to release water downstream. That to me was a huge red flag because, as you all know, the HCP, the Habitat Conservation Plan, which we've been working on and is extremely important that we get that thing completed, it's going to be all about the downstream releases. And I really don't think that we would ever end up in a situation where we could just not release water and just say, I'm sorry, you know, our copper levels are too high because we just treated a large algae bloom at the intake. And so I thought that warranted a little bit more look at, you know, is there a way to overcome that? What all is involved? Because I had really not thought about that. So the water quality lab manager came to the TAC in October, and she gave a presentation on all the things to consider regarding water quality if we were to take water directly from the lake and send it to the water treatment plant. So I just took a couple of her slides, that's what you have up in front of you. And she mentioned that these are the things on the left are things that we'd have to evaluate if we take Lopez Lake direct use, meaning it comes straight from the lake, goes down the pipe, and goes straight into the water treatment plant and doesn't sit in a terminal reservoir. we would probably have to adjust our aquatic weed control permit. There would be there are draft recreation plan guidelines we would have to address, because when you treat large blooms of algae, now you're dealing with recreation, which is a very important part of that that Lopez Reservoir. It might affect our Central Coast Basin Plan, how we meet the requirements of that, how it might meet the Habitat Conservation Plan. We'd have to do more frequent monthly sanitary survey inspections and enhanced stormwater treatment. So she brought up a lot of those things. And then on the other side, she had considerations for lake as direct source. And she also mentioned, again, state recreation guidelines, calculating out the dollars to bring the reservoir into compliance. Apparently, I was not aware of it, but there's a wastewater treatment plant back there associated with the recreation, you know, with the campgrounds, and it's actually doesn't meet the required setback. And if we were, but we don't meet the required setback if you take direct use of the water. So that's kind of a big, you know, issue to try to get on top of. We'd have to do more. And because we're not, that would not having the wastewater treatment plant far enough away from the lake would mean we'd have to do additional water quality monitoring, additional recreation staff, you know, more wastewater plant requirements. I mean, it's just kind of as a domino effect. And the other thing is that if we have this direct use of Lopez Lake water, from time to time, we would have to have more flexibility in from which intake we take our water. So there are 7 intakes at the lake. And right now we just adjust them to get the best quality water that we have, that we need. If we were to, we might have to monitor our downstream releases for dissolved oxygen, elevated iron and manganese, or algae. So she brought up a whole host of things that kind of put the brakes on heading down terminal dam decommissioning path for me, and as well for the tax. We presented all this to them, and it became clear to the TAC that we should probably turn our attention to getting that geotechnical information on the terminal dam before we make any further decisions, because we really just, it's not obvious anymore which way to head. So you will see this year we have, in our budget, we have about $89,000 budgeted, and we plan to use this $89,000 to write up the RFP for all this geotechnical work. And the project would actually be geotechnical work along with like a seismic alternatives study, like so that we know some choices. You know, this, we really don't know anything about what that terminal dam is on top of. It maybe it's not going to be that expensive to seismically retrofit it as opposed to going down the terminal dam decommissioning route. So the overall budget for that, for the geotechnical testing and the alternative study is looking at about, this is real round numbers, we don't really have any quotes or anything to base this on, is about $500,000. And so we are going to be putting the $500,000, we request that in the budget. And when we come back in January with the draft budget, Christy has a option so that the contractors do not have to get directly billed for this. And we'll go into this more in January with everyone. We've talked a little bit about it too. the TAC, and they understand, and they are also in favor of us moving down this geotechnical investigation and seismic alternatives study at this point. So I thought it would be important to let you know that we've sort of changed tack, because last you heard in July was that we were marching forward with terminal dam decommissioning process, and we've actually taken, we're ready to take a direction and ready to head towards terminal dam seismic retrofit study. So we have the budget. There's nothing that your advisory committee needs to do other than I just want to make sure you all understand, you know, or have any questions or anything you want to know about it. We'll do our best to answer.
Jill, I have a couple questions. This is Kristen. So the $500,000 approximately, we don't really know for sure if that's what it'll cost, but that's kind of what we think it might. That is going to be for the seismic retrofit study to tell us what it is we can do if we can do it to retrofit the terminal dam, correct?
Right. So they'll take core samples of the terminal dam, and we will find out what is it that terminal dam is sitting on. Is it sitting on bedrock? Is it sitting on sand? We really don't know that, and we're not entirely sure. I think we know what it's made of, but we don't know what it's sitting on, nor do we know about the adjacent area on each abutment, what it's sitting on, which are kind of critical pieces of information. Once you have that, then that helps direct what kind of alternatives are available to you.
Okay, understood. And then, so the $500,000 or whatever, if it's close to that, that's going to be put into the budget for 21-22, fiscal year 21-22?
Yes.
Okay. And so I missed kind of what you said about the agencies as far as being, so will we be billed for that, or that will just come out of our reserves, or do we not know yet?
It will come out of reserves, but I'm hesitating on telling you all, but there, so because it's a little confusing, and I'm sure Christy can do a better job of explaining it, but there are district designated reserves, which we've talked about, and we earmarked some of that funding for when we did the groundwater basin modeling. We've given, we did a stormwater, we gave money to stormwater plan. That's a district designated reserves, and when that pile of that little pot of money is gone, it's gone. It doesn't grow. Then the contractors have their contractors reserves. Mm-hmm. And generally, if there are savings from capital improvement projects and it's not used, that goes into their contractors reserves. Mm-hmm. Well, apparently, this was sort of me, but we also maintain an operations and maintenance reserves, and it is good fiscal financial I'm not saying the word right. It's fiscally responsible to keep 50% of your operations budget in your operations and maintenance reserves. So if your operations and maintenance budget every year is $500,000, you should have $250,000 in your operations and maintenance reserves. So Christy's done a great job of maintaining that. And at this point, we actually have more than we need in that operations and maintenance reserves. So yeah. One of the options is to use that amount that we are in excess and use that to help fund the geotechnical study.
So can I jump in? Jill, you did such a great job. Thank you. I just wanted to put in my two cents too that in the past, some of you may remember that if we had a year where we budgeted for the HCP efforts more than $100,000, this is the O&M reserves that we would fund that excess with, so that your agencies didn't get billed more than that $100,000. So we haven't actually dipped into these O&M reserves in the last 4 or 5 years. So they've been growing slowly, just interest in things every year, just a little bit keeps getting added. And I had noticed that we probably have the ability to use around $500,000 and still be maintaining our kind of 50% minimum kind of rule of thumb, you know, not dip below that. So I threw it out there for TAC, and they were very supportive of that so that your agencies didn't get billed next year during the budget process.
Okay, so sorry, one more question. So it looks like, Christy, it's going to be coming out of our O&M reserves. Is that correct?
Yes, and that is separate from the district-funded designated reserves that TAC and you guys have kind of earmarked projects for, that non-renewable kind of reserve. This is a separate bucket.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I have a fast question. So if we're talking about $10 million to retrofit, somewhere around $5.5 million to decommission, I mean, that's a substantial savings right off the bat. But if we retrofit, what is our maintenance and operation budget annually for that?
I'd have to look at what goes into that. I know that we have we have monumentation survey we have to do. We have piezometer reports we have to do. We have to make sure that there is no vegetation on the outside. It's not a lot at this point that I know of. One of the things about having the terminal reservoir, though, we do have maintenance associated with having the water behind it, which means, you know, we do treat algae blooms and we have to remove tules from around. So there is, you know, there's maintenance associated with the reservoir, but specifically to the dam, I don't feel like there is a lot. We do definitely have to read the piezometers and we monument, you know, we survey the top of the dam, that kind of thing.
And I guess my understanding of decommissioning versus retrofitting, if you're retrofitting, you're still going to be treating water. If you decommission, you're not, right?
Right. So, we would continue. If we retrofit the dam, then we would continue to use the terminal reservoir as it was designed as a, yes.
So it's potentially not just almost a double expense. I mean, there's a continuing operation of a treatment facility. But I understand the low DO and algae, there's some treatment considerations
right.
in either case.
Right.
Okay. And then just one other thing that came to my attention is if we decommission, there's a series of under drains underneath the concrete slabs of the dam. And I think part of the study needs to be what's the proper way to not just maybe seal those up at the surface, but to just make sure there's no way for water to build up in those and potentially lift the slabs out. Right.
Are you talking about the terminal dam spillway, or are you talking about the main dam?
The terminal dam spillway.
Yeah, I'm not aware of I'm only aware of that we did a main dam spillway assessment, and that's where they had the under drains. I don't remember reading too much about the terminal dam, but I can find out. Yeah.
Entirely possible that I'm misinformed there. I just,
What you characterized was what I understood for the main dam. That's why I was curious. But yes, and that is on our, on the next, the last item for tonight is the, what we call the bi-monthly capital projects update, which is attachment 8 in your packet. But does anybody else have any further questions on this particular CIP project?
Jill, this is Brian, and I wanted to acknowledge, the work that you guys have done to really uncover some of the issues that I think maybe weren't obvious before. But I do just have to say, my God, it sticks in my craw to have to spend $10 million to fix something that just, you know, on the face of it, seems superfluous or something. But, you know, maybe that's just the way things are.
Well, that, I'm hoping that it's, yeah, I just think it will, it'll help us inform it. I don't think we've decided one way or the other at this point, which direction we're going. We're just still collecting information. And I just think our estimate of $10 million to do a seismic retrofit was based off of the type of seismic project we did for the main dam. And they're really, they could be totally different types of remediation. You know, we had to do a very unique, expensive, I don't know if it was more expensive, but it was a kind of a unique fix to the main dam. And that had to do with the fact that the depth to bedrock that dam is sitting on was so low that they couldn't use any of the like traditional methods to seismically retrofit it. It could be a totally different situation over at the terminal dam for all we know. So at the very least, having this alternative study, it's going to fine tune our dollar amount. And we may still go down the decommission route. There's a lot of things to overcome, more than I had anticipated, if we decommission the terminal reservoir. So,
I appreciate you bringing those to light. Thank you.
Can I say something? So when the main dam was retrofitted, they took into consideration three possible alternatives. One was the chosen columns, and another option was to excavate and replace the downstream buttress, and the third one was excavating part of the downstream buttress. The reason why they chose the stone column construction was because it was the cheaper of the three. And it also, the excavating and replacing alternative required that you remove very large amounts of the downstream buttress. And there really was no place to essentially, or nearby, to store all of that excavated material. And the cost to haul in tons and tons of material in to replace the downstream buttress was actually more expensive. Now, for the terminal dam, it might be that the excavating and replacing alternative is much more inexpensive because you're talking about a dam that is a lot smaller in size. So that alternative might be more cost effective than the stone column replacement, which is what we use to budget the $10 million for. Replacing those stone columns required the use of very specific machinery, which is, again, to mobilize all of that is very expensive. So it could be potentially a lot less than $10 million is all I wanted to say.
That's all.
Jill, if I could just pile on maybe one more time, I think a couple things. To Brian's point, I think it's maybe a little bit of overreaction from Division of Dam Safety with the Oroville incident. And so they're looking at stuff much more conservatively. And so that's maybe driving us a little bit crazy, or potential to. And I think with the terminal reservoir also, with it being there, does give us much more operational flexibility than without. And that was something that I think we knew that, but when Faith came in, and that's probably the other takeaway, is we don't invite Faith to any more meetings because she just takes our ideas and throws them into the windmill. But just getting there. That was good observations. And again, the tax spent quite a bit of time grinding on this as well. So it does, and the money's there. So it does seem like as Jill's echoed, the TAC is recommends moving forward with Jill's recommendation.
Okay. Any other questions or comments on the terminal dam decommissioning update? Okay, hearing none, then why don't we move on then to the bi-monthly update?
All right. So in your packet, attachment 8 is a detailed report. We've already talked about a couple of things. A quick update on the spillway assessment. We've been waiting. We sent in basically our work plan for the next phase of testing for the main dam spillway to DSOD. They've responded and they had questions. We've responded back, and at this stage they're ready to have a conference call with us, and I think that's where we'll kind of iron out whatever last issues there are so that we can move forward with the next phase, which is our we're calling it, if it sounds bad, but we're calling it the destructive testing phase. Maybe physical is a better word for it. But initially, the assessment of the spillway was done strictly by, again, the non-destructive. So they tap little hammers and they listen for hollow spots. They look at the as-builds, they do that kind of a desktop assessment. So the next phase was to do potentially do some core samples, video the drain lines, do some of that work. And that's what we proposed to them. It looks like they're on board with that. So I would expect that over the course of this next year, we'll be embarking on that project to do this next phase of testing. And I'm looking here. We currently have about $190,000 to do that work. So either probably David Spiegel or Desiree will be working on the RFP to do this next phase of work. We've talked about the geotechnical testing. That's just a little summary that you see there. The fault zone risk assessment. This was also one of the projects where we had $180,000 remaining in the project, and we've gotten some quotes, and we believe that the risk study will only cost about $40,000. So we moved the remaining $140,000 over to help fund the cathodic protection. And again, it's in terms of the priorities of our staff time, it's a little bit lower than some of the other stuff we're doing. So it's still on the list. We're still working on it as staff is available. The good news is here in utilities, we're about to hire another engineer to help with all our different water systems. So yeah, I'm excited that we can put some more, energy into zone 3 and keep moving some of these things moving forward at a faster pace. The Lopez water treatment safety upgrades, again, a little lower. That sounds bad. It's not as high priority, but we are working on that. We told you about the cathodic protection repair project. So that's Desiree is going to be working on that to over this next year to get the RFP together and ready and out. The equipment storage building, again, as staff time permits, we're trying to move forward on that as well. There were a couple of unbudgeted O&M projects. One is the sludge bed curtain wall rehabilitation. We don't have an estimate yet on that cost. Again, working on that, that's an important one. That's probably going to take priority over some other things because it's the sludge bed. If it's leaking, that means it could be leaking into the terminal dam spillway. and you can't have that kind of stuff heading towards the creek. So that's priority. And I think the last one is it's an important one for to improve the efficiency of the plant, but it's not something that we have. It's been this way for a long time, but it would be a great project to do if we could improve. It would cut down on staff time. So that's the, they call it the aqueous ammonia room. The room just needs to be bigger. It's where they go. The staff has to go into this little room, and they have the, that's actually where they make the solution. And if the room were bigger, we could make bigger batches of it instead of going there every single day to make the batches. But again, it's important, but it's not as high a priority as some of the other stuff that we're working on. Upcoming projects for 2021 is some replacement of some turbidimeters, upgrading our EQ pump, and just some like equipment type stuff. And that is all I have on that. Does anybody have any questions about that? Okay, hearing none. I think we're on to the last couple items. Since there are no action items for the Board of Supervisors at this point. So we're to future agenda items. Anybody have anything requests? Typical future agenda items for us are cloud seeding updates, keeping you up to date on the contract changes, and there's another one. Oh, the HCP. We are starting to pick up a little bit with the Habitat Conservation Plan. I can bring you a better update on where we're at with that. It's being tied. The HCP is tied into somewhat the work that is being done on the AG sub-basin. Plan that we're doing modeling for, that we got a grant to do. So the AG Creek Groundwater Sustainability Plan and the modeling associated with that, that is going to help support the HCP. So there's been a little bit of progress on the HCP, but mostly we're going to wait and see how the Rio Grande Creek Sustainability Plan moves forward.
Jill, is that HCP the same one that has been floating around for like 8 years?
Four more.
Four more. Oh my goodness. Okay.
Yeah. They are. Yes. Well, we've held up on from time to time. I mean, we were ready to move forward on it, and then we were in the drought, and the agencies were looking at what would it look like if we moved to a storage model for the reservoir, which would mean changing the contract. So we kind of stopped working on the HCP because we needed to know what the contracts were going to look like. So once we know what the contracts are going to look like, then we understand better what's available from the Habitat Conservation Plan standpoint. Mm-hmm. We just basically had to put a kind of a halt on that until we found out exactly what we wanted to do in terms of the water supply contracts.
Okay, so, I wondered.
But it's still alive, and we're actually what we're currently moving forward on is the in-stream studies. So this is where they map the habitat in the creek, and they look at where is the habitat for steelhead and for the red-legged frog, and even the goby, which is way down by the mouth of the Rio Grande Creek. So we've recently reached out to every adjacent property owner to the creek, and we sent them all a letter letting them know that a consultant was going to be going by. They're putting temperature probes in the water. They're surveying, mapping, and they'll be going out probably all winter and into summer as they, because the habitat changes from season to season and with certain amounts of rain and certain amounts of downstream releases. So that is going to be extremely helpful in helping us move forward on the HCP. All the regulatory agencies are very excited that we're taking this next step. So it's very important.
All right. Thank you.
One question, Jill. I don't know if we cover this in this group or not, but the basin, the underground water basin management plan and the progress of how this region's doing in terms of the draw of the water versus what's happening, you know, Nipomo and South. Do we touch on that here at all?
Yeah, that is the Arroyo Grande Creek sub-basin, or Arroyo Grande Creek, I think we call it sub-basin groundwater sustainability plan.
Okay.
And that's going to look at the groundwater and its interaction with surface water. And that's a plan that's being done by Water Systems Consulting with several subs. Our Water Resources Division is heading that up. I'm not in charge of that one, but all the modeling that they will do to understand the relationship between surface water and groundwater will be melded together with our understanding and our model of our reservoir operations, and then we'll have the full picture.
Might be helpful to point out too that the Arroyo Grande sub-basin was classified as a low priority basin, which, you know, really removes, I guess, the priority in terms of getting that plan done compared to, you know, some of the high priority basins like Paso Robles or the San Luis Obispo Basin.
Yeah, what's driving this at this point is the fact that we have grant funding, and the grant funding that we got to do all the plan and the modeling has deadlines, and so that's what's driving completion of the groundwater sustainability plan, is to meet the grant deadline so that we get it paid for.
Understood. And thanks for that background, Brian. Appreciate that.
I just wanted to Karen's question about how long the HCP has been going on. I realize now I'm kind of one of the longest tenured people on this committee. I think it's more like 20 years at this point.
But, yeah.
I'll make it a point to ask John Wallace tomorrow, though. How's that?
Yeah. You're not far from there. I think it started around the 90s. The California Sportsmen's Association saying that we weren't releasing water, and so they put in a complaint, and then somehow that affected and we were in the process of trying to fix our water rights permit. And then the water rights permit people said, well, you're going to have to complete an HCP before you can fix your water permit, because you kind of have this outstanding complaint against you. And so that started the process. And yeah. Yeah, it's been a long time, absolutely. So I feel like we've made more progress in the last, 3 or 4 years. And although we've taken some turns trying to figure out what to do with our contracts, we at this point have so much more modeling and more information to help us develop this HCP that it's going to go a lot faster once we start moving forward with all this information we now have.
So we've got like future agenda items we've discussed. Are there any committee member comments? Anybody?
No, I'd just like to make the comment that I think the technology of these meetings has improved. So, Jill, thank you for that. I think the PowerPoint, the way that you ran that, and the rest of this GoToMeeting technology is working a lot better than it did a few months ago.
I agree. Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah. Well, I'll keep this up. This did feel a little bit smoother. So
definitely. And I'd like to welcome Ron. Thanks for stepping up and welcome to our committee.
Well, thank you. Yeah, thanks everyone for your patience as I kind of come up to speed and figure out when I'm going too deep into the weeds or getting too ingenuity, as I'll call it. I'll try to put on my layman pants as much as I can. And anyway, I'll get the feel of it before long. I look forward to all the work we're going to do together. Thank you.
And if there isn't anything else, then I'm going to say we're adjourned.
Bye-bye.
I like that.
Got
a good
idea.
Night, everybody. Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you. Thanks, bye. All.